Well, to get started, the title of today's seminar is Rheology of Liquid Crystalline Polymers, which in light of yesterday's lecture should probably be Rheology of Solid Crystalline Polymers, but I think that would be a misleading title. So it's an experimental view of theoretical needs, and Wes Burkhart and I will sort of tag team on this. I'm going to give the background, then Wes is going to give a state of affairs for lyotropic LCPs, particularly rheology, but some structure evolution type stuff. More recently, the past 4 or 5 years, progress has been made in understanding rheology and structure evolution of thermotropic LCPs. And there's some interesting differences with those materials. And so those are the two sections Wes will talk about. And then I'm going to bring up a new area that I think is ripe for some theoretical treatment, and that is looking at interfacial tension and interfacial effects in liquid crystals. So I think it's worth pointing out the different molecular architectures, first schematically and then with some real chemical structures that are available to us to study. Rigid rods and semi-rigid rods have been studied in the literature quite a bit. And there are examples of those synthetically. You can prepare these types of polymers. Another type of model, and I think there are examples of this that you can actually make, are the semi-flexible chains. And materials that I've worked mostly with are mesogen spacer main chain polymers. Those are fairly easy to make, and they also have properties that lend themselves well to experiment. There's also mesogen side chain polymers. These have been studied rheologically, but we're not going to cover them too much or at all today. So Wes put in this X.
I have a stupid question. What's the difference between a liquid crystal and a liquid crystal polymer?
Good answer. The molecular weight.
Well,
I like that answer.
Some of the architectures, side chain and main chain are very different and so on. So it's just a question of size.
Looking at just these pictures, you could also say the length to diameter ratio then is substantially different. And then but even in the small molecule pneumatics, you can have different architectures that are subsets of this kind of thing. When we get into the talk, Wes will address some of the, he'll bring in small molecule pneumatics and what we expect for their rheology as well. The real chemical structures, along with the cartoon of them, are shown here in a couple cases. In the past, the Kevlar, PBZT, these have been useful materials from a structural point of view. And the same materials that are useful as fibers tend to fall into the class of the either perfectly rigid or slightly flexible chains, like we show here. And so these are both commercial materials. This is a commercial material, and so is this. The fairly useless materials in terms of structural aspects are PBG and HPC. So you've probably heard these names in the literature a little bit. This is a rod-like polymer. HPC is more of a semi-flexible polymer. As we get into polymers that are liquid crystalline without solvent, so just melt to an ordered state, we see different structures. And this will be, I think, the end of the chemistry. But aromatic polyesters, so they have aromatic rings and ester linkages. And these are the commercial materials. They tend to be more flexible than the lyotropic rods so that they have a melting point that's below decomposition temperature. So,
I have a stupid question. Is there a well-defined boundary between those two classes? Because it looks like...
No, there isn't. Some fall into both classes.
So thermotropic is usually when you don't add solvent and it's liquid crystalline, then you call it thermotropic.
Yes. But that the same polymers, if they're persistent enough, will form a lyotropic mesophase at high enough concentration. But usually, an example where that's not the case is like these methylene spacer, these types of molecules. Generally, as you add more and more of that polymer to a solvent, you get to gelation or phase separation before it ever even forms a lyotropic mesophase, okay? But there's a number of polymers that fall into both classes. Okay, so, and these tend to be the academic type polymers that are lead to very reproducible rheological results. You can study them and ad infinitum, generating PhD thesis after another. But they're not terribly useful materials industrially because the strengths are low and the stiffnesses are low. So these flexible spacers cause some trouble in that regard. But as we make that flexible spacer smaller, we start to get to properties rheologically and mechanically that are close to the commercially viable materials. And so what drives this is a high specific strength and stiffness, and that's linked to the orientational order that you can achieve in the materials even without a whole lot of drawing. So polyethylene, you can achieve a high stiffness and strength, but you have to really refine your process to get molecular deformation by the drawing process. In LCPs, as you know, the local order is prescribed thermodynamically, so the job of the process of the flow, et cetera, is to get macroscopic orientation beyond the molecular scale. The molecular is already taken care of. We just have to align up all the domains.
Can you explain what this is for, in a glassy state or in a liquid crystal state, the strengths?
Oh, this is in the glassy state or the crystalline state. But the orientation when you, like just that, say S, the level of orientation as you go from the liquid state to the solid state, there's not a huge change. So it's prescribed in the liquid state and then it's vitrified.
And so how does the water parameter in the liquid state couples to the strengths in the glass state? Is that what you're trying to plot?
That's what I'm
The more it's ordered in the liquid state, the stronger the glass.
It will be in the solid state, exactly.
That's after it fails, or is the failure point?
This is plotting the strength, so that's the stress at break, and then this is plotting the stiffness. So on a stress-strain curve, the S is what I'm plotting. This is the same as this axis, but on a engineering stress strain curve, we're going to probably have something like this. And so this slope is directly linked to the level of water that was achieved in the liquid state by shear flow and then extensional flow. The strength, I don't know how good the connection is there between the molecular orientation and the value you predict there. And so that's why I think you can kind of be over a wide range in strengths, but the specific modulus is a little more predictable just by orientation. And so
the modulus is also in glass state.
Yes, these are solid state properties. Yeah.
The idea is what you quench from a given liquid state ordered or semi-ordered configuration into a glass to generate each one of those things. It's produced by just
more or less. In the lyotropic case, it's a coagulation. So you have a pneumatic solution. It goes into a bath that quickly gels the material. You might get a little more orientation by drawing, but it's not as dramatic as the change with polyethylene with the drawing process. And so online, what a lot of the fiber companies do is they measure by birefringence either right there online or just as the fiber comes off. And they know if I have high birefringence, I've got a good fiber. And birefringence is linked very closely to this order parameter, S. Okay, so that's mainly talking about fibers. Additionally, liquid crystalline polymers are used as moldings, especially the thermotropic case, because you can injection mold those materials. And it becomes mostly a curse than a blessing. The complexity of the rheology of LCPs leads to a very large skin core effect, and Wes is going to perhaps talk more about this, where the distribution of orientation throughout three-dimensional space is highly complex. Okay, so you'll have, and this is a plot showing contours of molecular orientation that vary dramatically across the thickness and width of such a plaque. And so one of the jobs we have is to try and predict this distribution of orientation in a material. And if we could make it more uniform, that would be good. But what people do industrially now is try to make it as isotropic as possible in order, because to make it more reproducible. So they'll add fillers and try to make molds such that you get as much randomization of the liquid crystalline order as possible. So it's sort of working in the wrong direction, but that's what they do for reproducibility.
That's for applications where you're doing precision molded parts rather than parts that are made primarily for strength?
Yeah, the only thermotropic product that's made for strength is film. And there they try to make biaxially oriented film. It's more along the lines that we would think, oriented as much as possible under control. But when you go beyond a few mils or a few thousandths of an inch thick and you start making parts like connectors, these kinds of things, they try to scramble the orientation. And there they're really just exploiting another property of thermotropic LCPs, which is small shrinkage. The density of the solid is not much different than the density of the liquid, and so they can get at least predictable dimensions out of their parts.
So they're not changing all the parameters, they're just adding the boundaries to make them smaller.
Yeah, so fundamentally it's anchoring the director in many locations throughout the sample. So it
gets frustrated, or is it actually case domain loss?
That may be the same thing. I think if you have enough boundaries within the material, the defect density cannot coarsen indefinitely. It's stuck at the distance between particles. And so we have two slides here about defect structure. One is sort of the traditional view that Ralph showed yesterday of sort of a granular material where locally we can define the director. And this would be characterized by an order parameter tensor. And if we reduce that to a vector model, we'll just have a director. It's got a certain orientation associated with it and a certain angle. And then in some models, you don't take that as a dynamic variable. You just say that's the degree of order for that temperature, et cetera. That's a highly simplified model. And what you can see here are brushes of the pneumatic texture. And those are an optical, most of those lines are an optical manifestation of where the director, as you go across this micrograph, where the director might become horizontal if the polarizers were oriented like this. And so it's a very continuous distribution of orientation in such a sample. And some of those lines, if we had a higher resolution, you would see are actual singular disclination lines. But many of the lines you see in these micrographs are actually not defects at all, just demarcations of where the director went through an orientation that gives you extinction.
I've got a question. Mm-hmm. I can't talk about this, but let's talk about these materials, specifically in the effects of stress. If you stress it over and over and over, how much will the stress strain relation change? Is that
much? Well, one thing we're going to talk about is textural refinement, which means the evolution of the length scale of this texture with accumulated strain. And that maybe you could call that a type of aging. Yeah. Scott?
Yeah, I'm confused about what you said about some of those lines being just in some sense artifacts of where the director goes through the horizontal. I don't quite understand why they'd be, line-like,
right,
if that was what was happening.
Let me put it this way. When you compare it with actual disclination lines, they're much sharper than the lines we see in this brush
you mean for low
pattern.
Microwave.
You see, it doesn't matter.
When you compare it with low microwave, what actual disclination lines are you comparing it with?
Half, plus or minus 1/2 lines.
No, but you're saying these images show a thickness. You're comparing that thickness to the thickness of some ideal disclination line that you assume, yes, that just means that in your low molecule.
Let me put it this way.
Let me.
Yeah. Let me put it this way, Scott. In this type of a brush texture, when you rotate the sample relative to the polarizers, you'll see that these lines shift. They're not physical entities. They're an optical manifestation of how extinction occurs in the polarizing microscope.
Some crystalline polymers. Yeah. You have dark regions there. That's not part of the sample. It's an optical effect of the local optical axis.
That's not to say there aren't discolination lines in this micrograph, but I didn't make this micrograph. But probably this is mostly populated by wedge discolination lines, where the line is actually coming out of the bore. A lamellar decorated image of this kind of thing is shown here, where we have two wedge disclination lines that probably form a loop coming out of the board. If we would rotate this under cross-polarizer conditions, we'd see that this brush would rotate as well. It's not, there's no defect here, but it would be a black line in the polarizing microscope.
Maybe you just point out here, if you were to rub out the areas that were horizontal or the areas that are vertical, some of them would be looking line-like. The vertical, there could be, if you're not really sensitive too much to how vertical it is, you could say, well, that the whole top of that micrograph would look dark. And then you
why those
things in the earlier picture weren't fatter, right? You're saying, why do they look so much like lines? Well, there's just not so many areas where there's a...
It's not concentrated spatially. This would be a very wide line. This would be a thin line.
Yeah, but why is it? Why is there a well-defined thickness of those?
It's not really
regions. I mean, why are they sometimes 10 times thicker? Typically 10 times thicker.
I mean, you can see some smudgy areas there, and those smudgy areas are areas where those lines are fatter, right?
Yeah, like here. This is dark. These may be the more well defined lines may be lines that are connecting these plus and minus one halves.
Yeah. Or where the director is bent more sharply.
Yeah. True.
But in that picture, if you look at places where you have crossed things, I mean, you know, things that look like brushes, forebrush textures, are those at least real forebrush textures? Are those also possibly artifacts?
Yes, they are real. Many of these are real forebrush.
Yeah, no, instead of looking at the lines in general, look at the place where
They cross, yeah, like here.
So those ones you'd say are authentic.
Yeah, with a point, a line in the middle. Yeah, I agree. But you have to do more than just take one picture. That's a microscopic technique I'll talk about at the end for the interfacial studies completely separates orientational order from orientation angle. And so you don't have these pesky ambiguities of the polarizing microscope. Okay, so, the reason we put these two slides in is just to highlight that the intrinsic texture that pneumatic symmetry lends is texture of line defects. And sometimes there's inversion walls, and some people have studied those, but predominantly these are line defects, and so the coarse picture is that this is a domain, etc. So a domain is defined just where locally the director's fairly well defined. But it's as you go from one region to the next, there's a continuous variation of the orientation angle. It's not a discrete change. The only discrete change is right at the core of the defect, and that's minuscule. Okay, to begin, and Wes will take over on the next slide, to begin the understanding of flow behavior of small molecule pneumatics has been fairly successfully treated by the Leslie Erickson theory, and a number of you have worked with it and thrown it away or worked with it and refined it. It depends on your point of view. But in the traditional Leslie Erickson theory, there's a number of constants. Three of the elastic constants describe the energy penalty of the gradients that exist near these defects or can be created by a flow. And these are the splay, twist, and bend elastic constants having units of dynes. And then there's a number of viscosities that are difficult to measure independently but can be measured as the three primary Meisowitz viscosities, that are measured. If you can anchor the director either in the vorticity direction or along the flow or in the gradient direction, these are the viscosities you would measure. So you can get combinations of the viscosities as derived in that equation, and these come from the stress tensor that Leslie wrote down. Other experiments can easily get at combinations of these and elastic constants. So for example, one experiment where you tip the director and then watch it relax will give us a ratio of like alpha 2 to K3 if in a particular arrangement. So often it's hard experimentally to separate the viscosity coefficients from the elastic constants. And by studying the distribution of the director real close to a disclination core, people can measure the elastic constants. And you know, there's many experiments to get at the elastic constants if you know something about the electrical properties, like the measuring the Friedrich's transition. Okay, so I think I'll turn it over to Wes now to talk more about lyotropic theory.
So I think one thing just to mention about the Leslie viscosities and elastic constants is, you know, if you open textbooks on liquid crystals, you can find these things for lots of low molecular liquid crystals. But it's important to have some sort of reality check. In the case of polymer materials, there are really only good data for things like Leslie viscosities for just one type of material. These are lyotropic solutions of polybenzoglutamate. And almost everything, even at this very basic level of the linear viscous and elastic constants, is still largely unknown in the case of polymer materials. So we have a long way to go. Okay, so Pat showed the schematic structure, the local pneumatic ordering, the director, and the way in which the director field wanders in so-called polydomain samples. Scott?
Why is that? Is it just because it's hard to prepare uniformly aligned?
Exactly. Most techniques for measuring these things fundamentally requires you prepare defect-free samples. And as that micrograph showed, if you just take any polymer material and look at it, it's filled with defects, and it's very hard to get rid of them. So that's it.
And why is it, therefore, practicable to do it for PBG?
I wouldn't say it's practical. It's really difficult. Through combinations of very high-strength magnetic fields and surface treatments, you can create monodomain samples, and a variety of different experiments have been done on PBG monodomains. So it's the easiest LCP to create monodomains, but it's not trivial. You don't simply put it in an alignment cell and it works.
The viscosity is much lower. That's the main.
Yeah. Okay. PBG has pretty much the lowest viscosity of any commonly studied LCP. That's exactly right. Okay, so associated with this multiple level of structures, we need to keep clear that there are multiple sources of elasticity. Pat mentioned the gradient distortional elasticity associated with spatial variations in the director. Under flow, the important dimension of this group is the Erickson number. It tells you how strongly the hydrodynamic torques on the director want to rotate the director compared to elastic torques that want to avoid distortion. You can write the Erickson number in a lot of different ways. If you look at it in this way, you can think of this as a product of a shear rate times some sort of relaxation time. Now, the Leslie-Erickson theory has no material relaxation time. Instead, you get a characteristic relaxation time for relaxation of distortions in the director field, and it requires that you impose, that you define some sort of characteristic length scale. So if you use H as being a sample thickness, then this would be the time scale it would take the director to relax. And as Pat said, you can turn this into experiments to measure combinations of viscosities and elastic constants. But since we're talking about polymers, the same way polymers have molecular sources of elasticity due to flow-induced changes in the local molecular organization, the same thing happens in the crystalline polymers, and you characterize these with the Deborah number defined in terms of some sort of molecular relaxation time. And in the case of lyotropes, this would be essentially 1 over the rotational diffusivity of the rods. Okay, this is maybe the most important slide I want to show. So my interests have generally been making mechanical measurements of rheology or measurements of average fluid structure. And if you buy a rheometer, typically you're going to be working with thicknesses, sample thicknesses of about a millimeter. For typical liquid crystalline polymers, both lyotrope and thermotrope, viscosities are around 1,000 poise. Elastic constants, as Ralph said yesterday, are universally about 10 to the minus 6 dynes. And so if you take these parameters and compute the characteristic relaxation time for the director field, you get something like 10 million seconds. On the other hand, characteristic molecular relaxation times in lyotropes are around 1/10 of a second. So if you just think about experiments you do in a rheometer under normal conditions, already at the lowest shear rate you might have patients to study, the Erickson number is already 10,000, and it just goes up from there. And so if you're working with, if you're thinking you're going to do simulations that will connect to very conventional experiments, this is a huge problem. And if you're working with theories that will simultaneously describe both gradient elasticity and molecular viscoelasticity, this is a pretty big separation of time scales, or as we'll discuss, length scales to try to cope with. So these are real, and this is the reality, the experimental reality, and this is a huge challenge for anyone that tries to do modeling. And I hope everyone that does modeling always keeps this in mind. Okay. So we want to talk about theories and models and stuff. Pat and I are maybe the wrong people to talk about them, so no equations really, just words. Pat introduced the Leslie-Erickson theory, where the Erickson number is a critical parameter. If you remove distortional elasticity, you're left with something called the Erickson transversely isotropic fluid model. If you'd like, it's simply set the Erickson number to infinity or neglect distortional elasticity. This is very simple. That's the sort of model that I think about a lot.
So can I ask you a question?
Yes.
That means that you actually treat it as oriented this way or permanently frozen in distortion? See, because you say Erickson is infinity. If you say that the
director... This just means that under flow, the only thing that influences the director orientation is the flow field, that there you've thrown out all elastic terms everywhere in the model. Yeah, so there's no gradient elasticity anywhere. Okay, so I'm exclusively interested in what flow does here. So the Erickson model tells you what the director will do in response to a flow field without any other constraints about bound reduced orientations or defects or anything.
I mean, the only reason I was asking is that if you prepare a sample, then there are built-in distortions
sure.
which take a long time to go away.
Oh, yeah.
So ER equals infinity would actually mean that whatever distortions you had in there are just sort of stuck.
Yeah, and in fact, in some sense, because you know, in polymers, generically, distortional effects are weak compared to viscous effects. That's really one of the problems you've talked about. That is, the defects are there, they go away slowly. And that's maybe a manifestation of the same thing. Okay, something I'll talk about is a model by Larson and Doy, which looks at this sort of polydomain structure and basically postulates that there's some distribution of director orientation. And that what they do is take this theory and phenomenologically average that over some distribution of director orientation. So it specifically tries to account for the fact that there is a spatial variation in the director field. I like this model a lot because it will actually predict things. I'll show you some examples. And that's hard to come by in this world. But there are a lot of phenomenological assumptions made in doing this averaging. And as a result, I don't think theoreticians or modeling people give it a lot of attention. But one of the things I'd like to do is encourage a little more attention there. Okay, so none of these theories deal at all with molecular scale elasticity. The dominant model that deals with the local molecular organization is the Doy model. This is formulated for rigid rod polymer solutions. As Pat mentioned, no molecules are perfectly rigid. And we also are interested in thermotropic materials with no solvent, and so it's not clear how far we can get with this. The Doy model is sort of a polymer version of the Erickson model in that it doesn't account at all for the possibility of distortional elasticity. What it does do is account for the possibility of molecular viscoelasticity, changes in the molecular structure, nonlinear viscoelastic effects of a more conventional type. And in this model, you have the Deborah number. Now, there are a lot of other theoretical developments. I just mentioned a few of them. People have tried to account for the effects of adding a little bit of flexibility to rod-like systems or having molecules with a lot of flexibility but still in an extended rod-like conformation. There's also been a lot of attention paid to sort of an opposite limit of high flexibility but still liquid crystalline. A pneumatic dumbbell model by Marucci Maffetone and Long and Morse also dealt with a similar high flexibility model in sort of a random anisotropic random chain limit. And particularly as you add flexibility to the models, you at least have some hope that these will move you more towards the thermotropic limit, and I'll talk more about that. There's a lot of interest and a lot of action in trying to develop what I will frequently refer to as so-called complete models. These are models that are sort of extensions of molecular theory that adopt a molecular picture of gradient elasticity. So these would be sort of the polymeric analogs of the Leslie-Erickson theory. They have gradient elasticity in, but expressed not in terms of gradients in the director field, but in gradients of, say, a molecular order parameter tensor field. And these theories, in principle, can do everything. In practice, they're complicated and hard to work with. And I apologize to everyone whose name I haven't put here in the appropriate spot. But the main thing is these models will allow you, within a simulation, to define both an Erickson number and a Deborah number. And again, if you try to simulate any experiment that I've done, those numbers are going to be different by eight orders of magnitude. Okay. One key thing you need to understand about pneumatics under flow is what they do in shear. And here, the simplest place to look is the simplest model, that is Erickson model. What does the director do under shear? There's a material constant lambda, frequently called the tumbling parameter, which is just a combination of these Leslie viscosities Pat mentioned. If the absolute value of this parameter is greater than 1, then if you subject the material to shear, what the flow fundamentally wants to do is line the director up at some angle. If the absolute magnitude of this parameter is less than 1, then fundamentally what the flow wants to do is rotate the director in a shear flow. Now, if you're interested at all in thinking about the way LCPs or any LCPs are used technologically, where the molecular orientation state is really important, obviously you want to know the answer to this question. Again, a measure of how little we know is that the answer to this question, are materials flow aligning or tumbling, is still a very active area of research. So this is the first and probably the most important question and still largely open in many materials. I'll talk more about that. Okay, so let me just show some sort of classic illustrations of complex rheology in lyotropic LCPs. If you measure normal stresses, ordinary flexible polymers, the first normal stress difference is positive. This is associated with stretching molecules out, elastic effects. If you measure N1 in polybenzyl glutamate solutions, it starts positive, goes negative, becomes positive. The more obscure second normal stress difference does the same thing sort of in reverse. This is really bizarre rheology. If you do transient flows at low shear rates in polybenzyl glutamate solutions, you get beautiful oscillations. If you so for instance, in a reversal experiment, the shear stress goes through these wonderful oscillations that scale perfectly with shear strain. If you do other types of transient experiments, say step up, you get oscillations that have different phases. And these oscillations are dampened out. And then there are interesting experiments if you shear for a while and then stop the flow and monitor the modulus with small amplitude motion, you see that there can be changes in the modulus of the material that evolve over periods of hours, and that the time scale over which these changes occur depend in an interesting way on the previously applied shear rate. Okay, so these are strange data, and I put them up because they all are largely understood and explained. So we know a fair amount about lyotropes, and theories and models have gotten us pretty far. So these stress oscillations are known to be due to director tumbling. We know that polybenzyl glutamate is of the tumbling type, and these oscillations you observe are simply manifestations of the tendency for the director to rotate in shear flow. The fact that there's strain scaling follows directly from the Leslie-Erickson theory, the hydrodynamic term scale with applied strain. The fact that the oscillations are dampened out is believed to be due to the fact that we don't just have a single director rotating. We have this polydomain system with heterogeneous distributions of directors, and they're also interacting with one another. The domains are interacting via distortional elasticity. And so that just causes the oscillatory tendency to get dampened out, and you lead to sort of a steady state distribution of orientation. You can think of this sort of maybe like a rotational diffusion in rod-like particles under shear. Since Gary's here, I gotta say that. And these are some model examples of what the Larson-Doy, this polydomain modeling approach can do. It can very nicely capture the qualitative characteristics of this type of transient data. So this is a pretty good success story. The bizarre normal stresses are known. Marucci and Maffetone figured out what the origin is. It turns out that as the director tumbles, it finds itself in a quadrant where what the shear flow wants to do is actually reduce the degree of orientation. So this is exactly the opposite of flexible polymers, where shear stretches stuff out and gives you a positive N1. Here, at least part of the time, the flow is pushing on the molecular distribution function, and it pushes back and gives you negative normal stresses. Now, fantastic. And this is our theoretical predictions of the Doy model. Now, remember, the Doy model has no distortional elasticity, so at low shear rates, it predicts tumbling, and it predicts time-dependent behavior that just stays time-dependent forever. So these predictions are simple time averages. Okay. By the way, the fact that the Doy model predicts tumbling means it has the right answer. In polybenzoglutamate, we know it's tumbling, and the Doy model is getting the right answer. As you increase the Debra number, you go through here a very simplified description of the nonlinear dynamics, a frustrated tumbling regime called wagging, and ultimately nonlinear viscoelastic effects cause the material to approach high uniform orientation at high shear rates. Now, there are all sorts of bizarre nonlinear dynamics that can occur in this vicinity that I'm not going to go into. Okay, so a lot of the nonlinear rheology associated with molecular viscoelasticity is actually very well characterized in terms of the Doy model. I mentioned the slow evolution of dynamic moduli. We know what causes this. We don't know exactly why it happens, but basically at low shear rates, tumbling leads to a decrease in the average degree of molecular orientation. If you turn the flow off and monitor the orientation, you see that it increases. And the rate at which it increases corresponds perfectly with the observations of these decreasing moduli. And so, like all liquid crystalline materials, if you improve the degree of orientation along the flow direction, that's where it presents a pretty weak resistance to flow or deformation. So it's this increase in the average degree of orientation. Now, when I talk about this, this is a low shear rate, low Debra number. The molecular order parameter isn't changing. What we're talking about here is a change in the distribution of director orientations in these polydomain samples. You always need to keep these two structural levels in mind. Okay, you'll notice that if we rescale time during relaxation by the previously applied shear rate, all of these data superimpose. This is another ubiquitous characteristic of relaxation phenomena in polybenzoglutamate. And remember, I mentioned that there's a characteristic relaxation time you can define from the Leslie-Erickson theory, but you need to impose a length scale. Here, it's common practice now to, in thinking about relaxation phenomena in textured samples, to think that the appropriate length scale isn't the thickness of the sample, but some characteristic spacing between defects. And the fact that we observe the characteristic relaxation times to go inversely with shear rate implies, in the context of these scaling arguments, that the texture has to go as shear rate to the minus 1/2 power. What that means is that if you define an Erickson number based on a texture length scale, that the Erickson number at these low shear rates isn't changing, that the sample is finding its own length scale in a way that will keep hydrodynamic effects and distortional effects in balance. Okay?
This texture, you should think of as a perfect length, so is it different?
The picture Ralph drew up on the board here yesterday is very relevant here.
So is the
thickness. I don't exactly know. I mean, the scaling arguments use a single length scale, but when you look at the sort of textures you get, and I'll show some pictures, you tend to have very elongated striped textures under flow, and so deciding exactly what these length scales should be is not always clear.
Sorry, that last comment went by me a little quickly. You said basically the system is refining the defect, the scale of the distance between defects.
Mm-hmm. Well, it works out to be about 100.
Okay.
And that's so, my guess.
Then your earlier remarks about the Erickson number and so on have to be rethought.
Well, I'll get to that. Yeah, I'll get to that. But the question is, what do you think you're simulating? If that's what you're thinking you're simulating, then great. But if you think you're, so, you know, I think that's a very useful observation, and I'll try to highlight something based on that in a little while.
So you need your model or your simulation or whatever to have some account of this texture refinement or else you're something.
Yeah, yeah. So of all the theories that I talked about, really only the Larson-Doi model attempts to deal with the presence of texture, with the presence of a domain distribution, and it has this sort of scaling built into it. So it reproduces the relaxation scaling. So, you know, some of these ideas are available in this model, but compared to the other two examples, there's a lot we don't know. We observe in experiments that the orientation goes up. If you ask the Larson-Doi model what happens when you turn the flow off, it actually predicts the orientation goes down. Other types of liquid crystalline polymers, the orientation goes the other way when you turn the flow off. So there are some things here that are qualitatively understood, but a lot of details that we don't have a handle on yet.
You look at these so-called complete models that you mentioned on the far right of that one slide. I mean, if you do simulations based on those, they actually show refinement of something, of structure.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously one of the things I'll be really interested in is where, what the status is in simulations of that sort, and that I'll be getting to that shortly. So I assume my own understanding of where we're at is out of date, but I'll be offering my opinions of what we should be hoping for. Okay, so those are things that work well. I want to talk about where things can go, and this largely follows into that direction. So where do defects come from? How do they evolve under flow? And so here I'm borrowing notation and ideas from Larson and Mead just to sort of introduce the range of things. Again, I mentioned that most typical experiments are up in this regime, but there's a lot of interesting stuff that can happen at lower Erics number. Larson's book talks about it a lot. And an important point is that as long as the Deborah number is small, you know, from the point of view of modeling or fundamentally, there's no difference between polymers and low molecular weight pneumatics. So a lot of what's known, particularly down here, is actually known more from low molecular weight pneumatics than polymers because it's so hard to get down here. Okay, and similarly, as long as the Deborah number is small, there's no reason, you know, the Lesi-Erickson theory should be correct. It can't deal with singularities. It can't really describe what a defect is at the microscopic level, but apart from that, it has everything you need to know throughout this whole region. It's straightforward to do Lesi-Erickson calculations at low Deborah number. For tumbling materials, as you increase the Deborah number, the Erickson number, things get more complicated. So it's not clear how far you'd be able to push it in that direction. I mentioned that the sort of experiments I do are typically operating out here, but you can simply narrow the gap and access lower Deborah numbers. So there's a regime here where calculations and experiments overlap and a lot of active and opportunities, I think, for interaction between experiments and simulation. So I'll show you some simulations on the next page that are representative of what's available now, and Jimmy will talk more about it. And basically trying to push up the Erickson number and describe how texture evolution occurs. Okay, it's in the scaling regime that the Erickson number becomes large. I argue that the macroscopic dimension becomes not important. All these scaling phenomena occur. This is really where the Larson-Doi model is all we have right now to try to cope with that. And I already briefly mentioned that a lot of the stuff associated with the Deborah number is apparently very well in hand. Okay, so let me just show you one example of what I think are really fantastic simulations. As you get Erickson numbers into the order of magnitude of about 1,000, the main phenomena that seems to lead to texture development is a phenomenon known as a roll cell instability, which leads to defect nucleation. Early stability analyses based on the Lesi-Erickson theory were done, but what I show here on the right are simulations of Fang and Neal, and I want to show these just to show you that, you know, these are complicated problems to try to cope with. We have looking down a shear flow into the board. What we see here is a representation of the secondary flow that's developed caused by the coupling of instability in the velocity field and the director field. And the director field itself, again sliced perpendicular to the flow, is very convoluted, very complicated. And when they push the Erickson number up pretty high, they begin to see the development of disclinations in this flow and can study their fate. And I can't say more about it, but we will hear more about this from Jimmy. This is just a typical experimental observation of Rolle cells. The sort of periodic light dark here is the optical effect of the Rolle cell, and then these lines coming through are actual defects that have been nucleated in the flow. So it's sort of in this realm that we have some experiments and the ability to simulate things in fine detail. Where
the flow direction there, I didn't understand.
Okay, so we're looking at a shear flow. The top plate is moving into the board, and this is just exactly. Thank you. Okay, these are some of my thoughts on where this stands. These simulations nicely show that we can simulate the sort of development of defects and how that's coupled with the flow field, but the Leslie-Erickson theory can't really give a realist accounting of the defect cores. There has to be something happening at the molecular level when these things occur, and if you're not accounting for that with a theory that can account for it, then you might not be getting the right physics out of the simulations. So the fix here would be to try to work with these complete models that have molecular representation of gradient elasticity, and Alex Ray has been working with models of this sort, and I know that you guys are pursuing this, and I really want to see.
Friday, I'll show the results.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay.
So you have a mirror picture of the previous slides for the Deborah number cascade.
Excellent. Okay. So let me just get back to this sort of fundamental problem. Again, for typical rheological testing, gaps of a millimeter, texture sizes in polybenzoglutamate, maybe 10 to 20 microns, defect cores are on the molecular dimension, say 100 nanometers for polybenzoglutamate, a huge range of length scales. Even if we think about typical Rolle cell experiments in polybenzoglutamate, here the gap is a tenth of a micron, or excuse me, a tenth of a millimeter, 100 microns. And if we actually want to use a theory that can resolve the interior of defect cores, then say a factor of 10 smaller than the size of a defect core. So this implies the need to have a grid with 10,000 points in one direction. This is a huge computational challenge, okay? And so there's really no choice except to impose very small length scales. And Scott, what you said about, well, maybe that's not such a bad thing, I think it's true. I'll talk more about that in just a second. But you need to do something to bring these characteristic length scales and time scales into closer coincidence, or you're just going to die computationally trying to do anything with these complete theories. What you hope, then, is that you'll learn fundamental information that if you're going to do anything with, and in a practical sense, you're going to have to develop some kind of multi-scale approach to feed this information back out. And I'll be really interested to hear what people think about this. Okay? So this early stage Rolle cell defect generation, as you continue to increase the Erickson number, you get into the scaling regime where the director tumbling, you just get increasingly complex and fine structure under flow. Manville coined the term director turbulence, and I think it's a good picture to have in your mind. There's no doubt that in the scaling regime, if you ask what's going on in typical experiments, the director and the velocity are fully three-dimensional functions of three-dimensional position and time-dependent. So it's a very complex state to try to simulate directly. The key idea of the scaling regime is that with all these defects, you basically have a screening of distortional elasticity. The fact that there are walls out there really stops mattering. And this is really the basic idea built in the Larson-Doy modeling sort of approach. And there's this idea of texture refinement that I already talked about that sort of maintains this balance. And a lot of experimental data are collected in this regime. And this is really, I think, although I'll be interested to hear progress, out of reach of really detailed simulation approaches. And that's what leaves us with things like the Larson-Doy model.
Just two quick questions about the distinction between tumbling and pneumatic experimentally. One is the defect texture just as pronounced because of the higher Erickson number even when they're flow aligning, or do you sometimes get something more like a linear flow?
Pat surprised the heck out of me a long time ago by measuring lots and lots of defects in the flow aligning material in torsional flows.
But less than in tumbling.
Yeah, certainly less.
It scales with the Erickson number of 0.5 instead of 1, but just phenomenologically. So at a given Erickson number, for a tumbling material, you have more. Because the difference is that in the tumbler, you have bulk nucleation of distillation lines at sort of these boundaries between roll cells. The flow aligners, you never see bulk nucleation. You only see creation of defects from existing defects. So you only need one to start.
Do these oscillations ever show up with the flow aligning material? Based on what you said, I was sort of tempted to think that if you see oscillations that scale the way you expect, then it's a tumbler.
That's one of the diagnostics you can use in the absence of the very difficult direct measurements of whether material is tumbling or flow aligning. Those stress oscillations are a good surrogate that have this nice scaling. Now, I don't know how far to go down this road. With flow aligning materials and transient flows, you can get some weird transients, but they don't have the same sort of character. They're this very regular, there are all sorts of data that show something that could kind of be oscillation, could not be, particularly in thermotropes. And it's really hard. You rapidly reach a point where you can't really read the tea leaves and decide, well, that's a oscillation due to tumbling, and that's just some strange experimental data.
I mean, heading back to an even simpler system, if you just take a suspension of rods, which ultimately, with Brownian motion, which is ultimately a flow aligner in the sense that the distribution function in a time-independent flow becomes time-independent, at short times, it oscillates too, right? Because it takes a while for phase mixing and stuff to occur to get a steady-state distribution.
Yeah, but I think of that as being more akin to where you get a steady state in the Larson-Doy model, where you have something that fundamentally is tumbling, but you end up with a steady distribution. If you had rods that could flow align, you wouldn't see those oscillations.
Keep in mind the difference between the dynamics of individual elements of this material and the dynamics of the distribution function.
Yeah.
Are fundamentally
different. Yeah. So when I was just talking about rods, I wasn't imagining a rod to be an analog for the entire domain, not a rod to be one of the individual molecules. And you'll go crazy thinking about these things. I have. Okay, so I'd like to talk a little bit about the Larson-Doy model. In the scaling regime, it predicts an orientation state that doesn't change with shear rate. In polybenzyl glutamate, we have measurements of molecular orientation that at low Deborah number show an orientation state that isn't really changing as a function of shear rate. So that works. It predicts, on average, in this distribution function, a small positive orientation angle. And we measure a small positive orientation angle at low shear rates. It predicts that the global distribution of direct orientations is not uniaxially symmetric, but it's a little bit biaxial. And with a little bit higher probability of finding rods oriented along the vorticity direction than along the gradient direction. And I don't want to define this, but these data show that, in fact, that is also true. So the orientation state is predicted not to change. The one thing that does change at steady state as a function of shear rate in the Larson-Doy model is the texture length scale. I mentioned that it should be predicting a scaling law of shear rate to the minus 1/2 power. We've done some measurements to try to measure this, and what we found was minus 1/3. Well, Ralph might draw a different line through the data. But at least the general idea of texture refinement is working. And I don't know if this minus 1/3 has something to do with this issue of how long our, what's the appropriate dimension to be thinking about when you have anisotropic shapes, when you have different length scales in different directions. Yeah, so this experiment involves, so the sample is pretty thick. We're going through a lot of domains, and we're basically measuring a characteristic distance through the thickness of the sample, a characteristic domain spacing through the thickness. So this would be measuring the small dimension in Ralph's picture. In the gradient direction.
Could you say just a little more about how you measure that distance along the direction of light propagating?
This is based on, you actually published a paper in this area. It's based on Natasha Belsara's depolarization in grainy materials, grainy optically anisotropic materials. It was modified a little bit to account for the fact that instead of having a random distribution of orientation here, there's a bias in the distribution. Exactly.
Sorry, can you say a little bit more about that?
Okay.
This is something like, Scott wrote the paper.
Okay, I'm sorry. So the idea is that we send it through light through cross polarizers oriented along the flow direction. So if you have a uniform orientation state, then no light gets through. What we have instead, if you'd like, and here I'll be crude, are domains with some spread in the distribution. So as the light goes through here, depending on the spread of the distribution and the size of the grains, the polarization state gets a little bit scrambled.
Yes.
Neighboring light paths experience a slightly different retardance. And this causes light to leak through. And you can do an analysis of this to show that the intensity of the light that leaks through should be proportional to both the degree of spreading in the orientation, and we know that that is constant in this regime, as well as the texture length size. And so this measurement of transmitted light intensity should be directly proportional to the size of the domains that we're passing through.
So that length, it's something like a mean free path for getting the polarization, or is it some other thing that comes out of fit to the kind of thing that's caught or that's already?
I'm not exactly sure how to easily explain it. It's been way long since I did the model. You basically postulate you're going through a stack of things with different orientations, and what we're calling the texture length scale is just the thickness of each element in the stack of randomly
mean-free path for changing polarization state.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I'm just not understanding the language well enough, but I think you get it.
Can you actually get the number out of that, back just to scale?
To get the number. We looked at it a little. The number we got wasn't that good, and to get the number, you need the single grain birefringence, and you also need a number for the sort of degree of dispersion. The analysis makes an assumption that the degree of spreading is not large, and in fact, the degree of misalignment we measure is pretty large. And so I think there are perhaps some questions in treating the model quantitatively. What I hope is that the scalings in the model are pretty robust. And we just to go back to this, we did some tests. In principle, the intensity ought to depend linearly also on the sample thickness. And we did a test to verify that scaling was seen. That's the different sets of data. And then the intensity should also have a certain dependence on wavelength. And we did independent tests to make sure that the dependence on wavelength was satisfied. So the scalings seem to be robust enough for us to believe that we're actually measuring what we think we're measuring. In addition, the data you showed from light scattering estimates of the texture size sort of bracket this. Those were 0.2 and 0.4. So I think there's reason enough to believe that the scaling properties at the most simple level, there's definite reason to believe that the texture length scale is getting refined, and that's maybe the most important thing, that this idea is correct. But I'm not sure I trust what we've done to that model the optical model well enough to believe absolute numbers. Okay, so the data of the sort I showed you really gives us a lot of information. We can extract a second moment tensor of the domain distribution function from the type of data I showed you, and that's exactly the sort of thing that the Larson-Doi model is purporting to predict. Okay, I mentioned I like this model because it actually predicts things. I measure things, and so I like models that I can predict. So we could do this 10 years ago, and I would love for more comprehensive, detailed modeling efforts to get to the point where we could make similar comparisons. In the meantime, since this is the only model that can predict anything, I do think it bears a little bit of effort on someone's part to see how well it can predict things. So we see that the Larson-Doi model overpredicts the degree of anisotropy in general. There's a possibility that this is a consequence of a decoupling approximation Larson and Doi used in the model. Kawaguchi and Den dealt with a very similar model. They solved the model in two dimensions and found that the pre-averaged model predicted a much higher anisotropy than the one without the decoupling approximation. So if any of you mathematically inclined people are looking for some really low-hanging fruit, just do the same thing. Treat the Larson-Doi model without making the quadratic closure approximation and figure out what it predicts. There's can you make this look more like that? I'm not sure how much work there is, but you know, there's a paper waiting to be written for someone to do that. Something a little bit more involved, but I think still to some extent worthwhile, thinking about wanting to do something towards simulation of processing. This again is the only model that really deals with this dominant characteristic of polymer LCPs, the distribution of domain orientations. To my knowledge, no one has really made any attempt to use this model to simulate a complex flow field, to try to do fluid mechanics with it. Yeah. Think about it.
Why are the off-diagonal elements non-zero?
That reflects the fact that the director distribution function has a slightly positive orientation angle in the shear flow. It's not the average domain orientation angle is slightly positive.
But n is defined either way. Maybe it can point in the opposite direction.
This is an axis fixed in the flow.
Yeah, so we have shear flow like this.
Yeah, in principle, axes were n.
And basically, if you imagine a bunch of domains, that on average, there's a small positive alignment of the domains relative to the flow direction. Okay. If you just took the Erickson model and in a tumbling material and time averaged it, then on average things would be symmetric. But because the Larson-Doi model includes some interdomain interactions, very much the term acts very much like rotational diffusivity. So as those interdomain interactions kick up, you end up with a positive orientation angle, the same way you would for a dispersion of rods under the influence of Brownian motion.
How do you measure this matrix?
This was from a combination of experiments. This is a birefringence measurement with the light sent along the velocity gradient direction. To get these other pictures of the orientation state, we then did an optical experiment where we sent a light beam through at various oblique angles and measured how the birefringence changes as a function of the light path within the shear plane. And that allows you to collect all the components of the refractive index tensor, and we're assuming that the refractive index tensor is basically proportional to this moment of the distribution of domain orientations.
Do you calibrate everything by producing a single monodomain and look at birefringence?
Yeah, so we did that with polybenzyl glutamate. This is the monodomain birefringence. If all the domains were lined up in the same direction, this is what we would get. I don't want to emphasize the nonlinear stuff, but so mainly with Larson-Doi we're talking about down here, but this is where N1 changes sign, which gives you a measure when the Deborah number becomes significant. We see a big increase in orientation. That's associated with the transition from tumbling to flow alignment. You'll notice the average orientation angle changes sign. That agrees with Doi model predictions, and that's really vital to understand where the negative normal stresses come from. You need there to be, it needs to be pointing down into this wrong quadrant in order to get the origin of the negative normal stresses. And so there's more here that we can get from these three-dimensional studies. Stuff up here is Doi model related. Stuff down here is Larson-Doi model related.
Guides to the eye.
Guides to the eye. Yeah, I can show you pictures that show Doi model predictions side by side with this, and you can see for yourself the extent to which they agree or disagree.
The accuracy of these numbers are better than.
Yeah. Well, you can see, for instance, here the orientation angle is changing a little bit. What's happening with the transverse anisotropy is not completely clear. To get that matrix, I've basically taken one data from one shear rate and constructed this matrix by comparing relative to the monodomain birefringence. So I would say, I'd be comfortable with 10%.
But then it's not that much different from you.
I'd be more comfortable than that. What's important isn't so much the numbers here, but the difference. So the differences are larger. The difference in the differences is larger than the difference in the absolute numbers. It's a significant, let's go to the monodomain. What we measure is something around 50% of the birefringence in the monodomain. What the Larson-Doy model predicts is around 80 to 90% of the monodomain birefringence. So it's a significant overprediction. It's not a small thing. And well within, say, our ability to measure this number accurately. Okay, so what can we do in this scaling regime? So can we start with roll cell simulations and just push the Erickson number higher and higher and higher? Maybe. I don't know how far that can be go. But I really think you're going to have to change the simulations to fully three-dimensional. Right now, the roll cell simulations don't allow for any change in structure along the flow direction. But once you can take those sort of simulations and you can actually evaluate this tensor. And if you can get the simulations high enough, presumably you could compare directly with those types of experimental data. I think a direct attack starting at the low Erickson number limit and working your way up with complete models is out of the question. And here we get into the point Scott was making. Within the scaling regime, this material is determining its own texture size, and the macroscopic dimension isn't really relevant. Is irrelevant. Now, one picture of what the end of the scaling regime at the high shear rate end is when you've basically shrunk domains down to the point where you're approaching molecular dimensions. So rather than, let me go back here, rather than imagining starting way down here at small Erickson number and trying to work your way up, I think a much more productive approach would be to try to target the high end of the scaling regime directly, just make a direct attack at that. And maybe you guys are already working in this direction. But the sort of thing I have in mind is to take one of these complete models, forget about director boundary conditions, homeotropic planar, use periodic boundary conditions so that walls aren't in the problem. I think this has to be a three-dimensional computational problem, which will be terrible. I imagine just quench into the pneumatic, allow it to course in so you have some defects, something there to get it started. Start the flow up. You have fully coupled three-dimensional director and velocity fields. That's a big issue. And once you have this detailed structural information, I think you can, one thing you can imagine doing is trying to do a better job with where Larson and Doy had to make phenomenological choices. That is, feed this information into a more coarse-grained average model with much better insights. And I think perhaps a holy grail would be to do something like a Larson-Doy model, but base it on a complete model rather than the linear continuum model. So you'd have an average model that accounts for the distribution of domain orientation, accounts for inter-domain interactions, and also has the potential to push you all the way up into the nonlinear viscoelastic regime. So that's where I hope that computational efforts are directed. Okay, let me now start to talk about recent stuff on thermotropes. I'll try to move through this pretty quickly. Talk a little bit about chain flexibility, rigid rods, Doy model says tumbling. If you look at the theories for slightly bent rods, they become even more tumbling, more prone to tumbling. But if you jump all the way over to the limit of high flexibility, still liquid crystalline, all the models predict flow alignment. So something interesting happens. And remember that thermotropes are more likely to be over here somewhere. I want to mention work targeted at flexibility, this hinged rigid rod model of Gurry's. I'm not exactly sure how to think of it along this axis. And I don't even remember whether it's more or less tumbling than a single rigid rod. But
depends on what you put in for the
connector?
Well, for how stiff the hinge is.
OK. Yeah, so you could presumably do something very much like this with a stiff hinge and hopefully get similar results. Okay, so I guess the next 10 slides, I want to basically make the point that we know something now, and that is that it appears that the general rule, not an absolute rule, but it appears that this type of main chain thermotrope is flow aligning. We know this for sure in the polymer that Ralph was talking about, this DHMS79. Mesogen with flexible spacers. Julie Cornfield's group worked really hard to make a monodomain of this polymer. It was on a pretty low molecular weight sample to get the viscosity low enough to get the defects out. But once you have a monodomain, you can actually make quantitative measurements of lambda. These are the measurements of lambda as a function of reduced temperature relative to the isotropic pneumatic transition. Wei-Jun took measurements of the monodomain birefringence to get an estimate of the molecular order parameter, and these are the data of lambda as a function of the molecular order parameter, along with the predictions of many different models. This is DOI model rigid rods. This is Marucci's pneumatic dumbbell. This is Semenov's treatment of the high flexibility limit of persistent chains. And this is Archer and Larson's model for small molecule liquid crystals. Okay. If you create a monodomain and you create a planar monodomain, so the director points like this, and now you apply a shear flow. If it's tumbling, the director will rotate this way. If it's flow aligning, the director will rotate that way. And you can monitor the sense of the director rotation with an optical method called tenascopy. If you measure the rate at which the director rotates as a function of strain, you can get a quantitative measure of lambda. So it's very unambiguous, very direct, but requires that you have a monodomain to start with. And that's the kicker. Okay, so you won't see many data like this anytime soon, but at least there's one set of data to play with. Another type of this mesogen spacer are the PSHQ polymers that Paul Hahn at Akron, Pat has done a lot of this work. We've dabbled a little. There's a lot of indirect evidence from rheology and structure under flow texture that these are also generally flow aligning, although in some situations, particularly as the spacer length gets shorter, it appears there might be tumbling in some circumstances. Okay? So I want all the people that do modeling to think about this because, just these data present some, I think, theoretical issues. The theories describe very highly flexible or just slightly flexible, but I don't think any real material is yet addressed by theories. In particular, with these semi-flexible things, there's a lot of discussion about hairpin defects. These are neutron scattering data from France where people have measured the size of a main chain LCP coil perpendicular and parallel to the field direction. This is the cartoon they draw to indicate sort of what they have. There are a couple of hairpins, not enough hairpins to have the sort of anisotropic Gaussian chain of Long and Morse to sort of reach that limit. So one really nice thing would be a molecular theory of lambda for chains with a couple of deep defects per chain. And Dave says he's working on that. I think something else, Semenov has the semi-flexible chain approach. There are predictions existing for the high flexibility limit. It would be great to have lambda as a function of L over persistence length. I don't know how hard that is. It must be hard because it hasn't been done. Once you're getting into thermotropes and melts, entanglements, I don't know. Okay. But aligning LCPs are much simpler. And so let me just try to convince you of that. These are orientation data. You quench into the pneumatic phase, start up shear flow, and using X-ray scattering, you measure the development of orientation. Things scale nicely with shear strain. That suggests we're in the low Deborah number regime. The orientation just grows monotonically. In shear stress, there's a single shear stress overshoot, also scales nicely with shear strain. Okay? Now, since no one else is doing modeling of flow aligning materials, we took a crack at this and we did the simplest thing you can imagine. That is, go all the way to the Erickson number, no distortional elasticity, no anything. We just wanted to account for the distribution of domain orientations. So if you'd like, this is like Larson DOI without any distortional elasticity, except we also don't have any decoupling approximation either. We simply simulate an initially random director ensemble of directors and watch each of these individually goes towards the flow alignment angle, and then we can compute ensemble averages that we should be able to compare with experiments. To make stress predictions, we need viscosity coefficients, and we got these from the pneumatic Rouse model or pneumatic dumbbell model. So it uses this high flexibility models to get the viscosity coefficients.
Is this like a suspension of rods with a tumbling parameter above one?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And I assume that a clever person could actually get a closed form solution for the orientation distribution function, but we just simulated it. So these again are the data. The solid lines here are predictions of the development of orientation. You see we get, the model predicts a nice monotonic development of orientation. And in order to fit the data, we need to choose a value of the tumbling parameter pretty close to 1. The measurements of the tumbling parameter for this polymer were also very close to 1. We can predict the evolution of shear stress, and you see we predict a shear stress overshoot. And I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that instantaneously the stress starts very high, goes through an overshoot, and then comes back down. And that's exactly what the data do. So with no work, really, we can simulate some aspects of this. There are a few heuristics that emerge from this. We see we get a single stress overshoot. One interesting thing is that if we use the viscosity predictions of these molecular theories, then once we get to the flow-aligned condition, it turns out that if what these theories predict is that the ratio of steady N1 to shear stress depends only on lambda. Okay, so it's, if you know you have a flow-aligned material, this is a way to figure out what the tumbling parameter is. The other thing is we see from the modeling that the magnitude of the shear stress overshoot increases as lambda gets closer and closer to 1. So lambda controls both steady state N1 over shear stress. Lambda controls the magnitude of the shear stress overshoot from an initial random orientation. And so without making any adjustable parameters, we can go to our polydomain model, do simulations of how the shear stress overshoot relates to the steady state N1 over shear stress. That's the line. And the symbols here are data from Paul Hahn at Akron, where he's done a whole bunch of materials of this sort. And so the fact that this seems to work, whereas I'm not sure any of you would have suggested doing this correlation in the first place, really suggests that these polymers seem to be flow aligning, that as simple as it is, this model is able to get a lot of the physics of the stress overshoot. And since to get the stress predictions, we had to use the predictions of the molecular theory, it also provides some support that these molecular theories have something to do with this type of molecule, even though we don't have a lot of hairpins per chain.
You went a little too fast for me.
Yeah.
At one point, you were saying lambda was about 1.
Yeah.
And you said N1 over sigma was something like 1 over square root of lambda squared minus 1, and that would make...
No, for flow aligning, lambda is slightly bigger than 1.
Oh, so it's bigger than 1.
Yeah. But the values we measured ranged from 1.00 something to around 1.05, depending on temperature in that material. So it's bigger than 1, but very close to 1.
It's almost I think almost always pretty close to 1.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any materials with huge, you know, lambda 5.
So it means N1 is much bigger than...
Yeah. So in what you predict at steady state is that N1 and shear stress should both be linear in shear rate, and the ratio of them should be constant, and N1 is much bigger than shear stress. And that's, I mean, if you look at data, you know, the issues of possible contributions from distortional elasticity, and you know, it clouds the picture, but a lot of data sort of look like that.
But Julie measured for DHMS that lambda was really close to 1, right?
Yeah.
But I don't remember normal stresses in steady shearing DHMS.
In DHMS, this whole apparatus doesn't work quite as well. You're right. The rate N1 to shear stress was maybe 3 or 4 in that case. It was much bigger than shear stress, but not really big. And we think the problem is that DHMS has a pretty low viscosity, and you know the modeling is assuming that you know, the hydrodynamic torques are having their way and lining everything right up at the flow alignment angle. If you have a material with a low viscosity, it's possible that the hydrodynamic torques might not be enough to get the ultimate alignment good enough. And the magnitude of all these things depends on getting this thing all the way down into the flow alignment angle. So I think that's perhaps a good example of why we need better modeling. We don't have any distortional elasticity in the model, no defects. These things are certainly important. One sign of this is that although the shear stress predictions I showed you look good, we can't get good N1 predictions. I postulate that there's a much stronger direct contribution from distortional effects in the first normal stress difference, and we don't have distortional elasticity, so we can't get it. I think this is a great opportunity for complete models. One reason is that unlike tumbling systems here, even if we start with a complicated state, it wants to evolve towards something much simpler. So I think that's a huge difference. And as a result, I think even if you do simulations in restricted dimension, you have a much better chance of getting something that is relevant. And the real issue is if we start with defects and you